don't know me, my name's Rebecca Jakes. I look after the researches and platforms for Deutsche Asset Management. You're actually going to hear from two speakers today, and they are the gentleman here to my right, which is Paul Spence, who is our Global Head of Portfolio Engineering and Analytics. He's actually going to walk through with you how we actually incorporate into portfolio construction that some of these what we call megatrends. Other groups may call them specialist investment strategies, but they're increasingly arriving on the arena. Bill Barber is our director and investment specialist, and he will walk through with you exactly what are the megatrends as how we define them, and some of the products that we are releasing that help you access these megatrends.
Thanks, Beck, and thank you, everybody, for choosing to come to this session. We're delighted to see so many people responding. As Beck said, I apologise for the way we've got this sort of ask about, but essentially we do see these megatrends driving investments, and some of you would know we run a global thematic fund, and what we're looking there are for things that we see as being inevitable, a case of not if these things are going to happen, but more when will they happen. And we use these mega trends and themes to help us identify tailwinds for companies that fit these ideas. And then it becomes very much intensely bottom-up and valuation-driven, which is the way we choose to use to do thematic investment. But some of these things are fairly obvious. The soaring world population, that's something that we do obviously see as inevitable. We're 6.6 billion people now. We're going to be 8 billion over the next 12 years. That's roughly 80 million new mouths to feed every year, 8 people being born about every 3 seconds. So we're a pretty busy lot out there. We're looking at increased demand for food as a consequence of this, and I'll talk a little bit more about that shortly. Climate change we do see as inevitable now. I had been a little bit of a skeptic on climate change for a number of years. Last year, though, I think the evidence became very, very compelling, and in the last month or so, that evidence has become indeed very, very compelling, despite a few Luddites that still remain in the Liberal Party. And basically, emerging markets is another force there that we see as being unstoppable as well. The wealth effect that's coming and bringing 3 billion new consumers to the world is a huge force, and it's driving the markets out there and profits for companies. So let's look at agribusiness, or the things that are driving population growth. I mentioned that we're 6.6 billion going to 8. The strongest part of that area is within the developing world. We're seeing very, very large increases across areas like India, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and in Latin America. Urbanisation is another reason. As we have urbanising economies, we get extra growth occurring, and that tends to lead to higher incomes, which requires more food. And we also obviously have an increase in life expectancy, so as people live longer, there's a need for more food. The really exciting part of this, though, is we have rising incomes. And I'm not talking about mega wealthy people. I'm talking about people coming from $1,000 moving up to $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, $6,000. Now, if you think about it, if you're just earning $1,000 per annum, you can't spend any more money on food. It's all going on food and shelter. But as people go up from $2,000 to $3,000 to $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, they spend a significant part of that extra income on food, and it's leading to big demand for extra protein across the emerging world right now. We've seen food inflation in China this year, pork prices up about 90%, chicken up about 45%, eggs up about 30%. This is part of the reason for that. And obviously in the Western world, the developed world, where we've got wealthier people, we've got this demand for healthier food and organic food. And this is all leading to possibilities for companies. The limited resources, by this we mean simply that there's a finite amount of land there that's suitable for agricultural purposes to grow food on. You could argue we could cut down more lowland rainforest, more lowland forest, and sure we could, but that's going to lead to that fourth thing we see as inevitable, and that's climate change. So we certainly don't want to go there. And if you just consider the land for the time being, we've got the impact of urbanisation as cities spread, Beijing, Shanghai, the eastern seaboard cities of China. Sydney, Melbourne are classic examples. These cities are where they are because initially this was the best agricultural land that those early settlers could find, and we've consumed a great deal of agricultural land. We've also seen the impact of salt degradation in countries like South Africa, Australia, the United States, and particularly now in China. And that's a big thing. It's taking land down. And if we actually look at the land on a per capita basis, it's in serious decline. So they're the things that we see driving agri trends. This is looking at the population growth, as I said, going to 8 billion by 2020, 9.5 to 10 billion, depending on which UN body you happen to pick. You can get that up to that by 2050. This looks at the rising income levels. You can see we've broken it up into four areas. Developed countries, where there's roughly 631 million people earning above $10,000 per annum. And we're interested in this group here, the lower to middle, the upper end of this group, and the lower end of this group. And this is where this big demand for food is going to be increasing. And as you can see, there's over 3 billion people in that sweet spot right now. I'll skip that slide. And I'll look at global warming. This looks at the impact of putting in a 1 degree rise in climate change all the way through to 2, 3, 4, and 5 degrees. And basically, at a 1 degree rise in the temperature, you can actually start to get initially some benefit at higher altitudes. But as we go higher, we get falling crop yields in many areas. And as that goes on, you get falling yields in many developed regions. Water is a key problem in all of this. There's no doubt about that. Already we're starting to see some small glaciers disappearing. Basically, as that temperature rises, you can see we get significant decreases in water availability in many areas. And basically, sea levels rise. This starts to threaten major cities. We're already starting to get some coral bleaching and damage to reefs, and this can lead to a rising number of species facing extinction. We get extreme wet weather events. Perhaps we're seeing those already. Rising intensity of storms, all these sorts of things. And if we keep rising this up, we can do some irreversible damage to the climate. This can create some significant investment opportunities. One of the things I'd like to talk about is just the global temperature. It's rising. We're up about 0.6 of a degree over the last century. Much of that has occurred from the Industrial Revolution in about the 1870s, we've seen a significant increase in global temperatures. When you look at 0.6 and you say, well, gee, that's not that much. Why is that important? Well, the average global temperature is only 14.5 degrees. So if we're talking about 1 or 2 degree rises, in percentage terms, this is a very significant amount. How do we know these things are happening? We can now go back through drilling down in the Greenland ice shelf 650,000 years, and we can analyze what the atmosphere was like when that was put down, so we can measure the amount of CO2 that was in the atmosphere. And right now we're at around about 420 parts per million, which is way off the scale over the last few years. I'm not sure if those slides are in this presentation deck. I don't think they are. Okay. If those of you wish to come back, we might try and get the right presentation for the second lot. Obviously, this thing, there's some stuff in the Stern report that shows there's some significant expenditure required. The key message in all of this is that this is actually reversible. We've made nitrous oxide. We've done work on that. We've done work on the ozone depletion. That can be replaced by about another 50 years of work with the atmosphere healing itself by taking chlorofluorocarbons out. And carbon dioxide is a similar thing. It can be fixed. If we take action fairly quickly over the next 20 years, it could cost about 1% of GDP globally per annum to do this. If we don't do that, we're going to have some serious problems. If we get 2 degree to 4 degree rises, you're basically in danger of losing the polar ice caps. That leads to 2 to 4 meter water rises, and this could lead to massive climate change and affect the human race. So these things are there. We believe that the expenditure required to do that, as I said, is about 1% of GDP, and that really could mean that there's revenue involved for corporations here that is very, very significant. It's in the hundreds of billions of dollars for companies that can act for this. Emerging markets are a key important thing. Why would you put those in a portfolio? This looks at the 10-year risk and return. And you can see over that period, if you'd put all your money into the MSCI World Index, you'd have generated a return around about 8% at a fairly low level of risk, around about 12 standard deviation. And basically, if you'd had all that money in the emerging markets, you'd have had a lower return with significantly more risk. So, gee, why bother? Well, the whole thing is this has been turned on its head. And basically, if you look at this now, over the last 5 years, you can see emerging markets, the period we did this, the MSCI actually had a negative return over that five-year period, and the emerging market portfolio had done about 12%, again, with significantly more risk. The key thing is that by combining them in portfolios, you can see here you would have enhanced your return and you could have actually reduced volatility in your portfolio. And we think this is the way it's likely to be in emerging markets going forward. There's that potential for extra alpha. It's very company-specific, though. It's not just emerging markets versus the developed. It's a case of finding, through looking at the world holistically, companies, it's irrelevant of where they're really listed. You just want the ones with the highest growth potential. So on that happy note, I'll leave it for Paul to start talking about how we incorporate some of that into portfolios.
I'll start here. That's fine. There was a slide at the start that talked a bit about my agenda, I guess, but the history of portfolio construction goes back a long way, back to Harry Markowitz in the early 50s. And if you happen to read any of his papers or books, he talks about total risk and total return, these concepts of active risk and active return, tracking error, information ratios. It's kind of a new phenomenon in the sense of in the last 20 to 30 years, roughly, we sort of really talk about these things. And it's interesting to read Harry's book from 1959 called Portfolio Selection, just to go through the logic. And it's something that we've kind of lost, in my opinion. I worked at Barra, the risk modelling company, for a long time. It's very much focused on risk, which is great, and then what sort of risk, tracking errors and a whole lot of other things. But when you start to build portfolios, as you people do, tracking error is not the only consideration that you should have. As an active manager, tracking error is our consideration. However, there is evidence that we should look at more things than just tracking error. And there was a presentation, I believe, yesterday morning that talked a lot about other measures of risk, not just volatility as we sort of defined it as standard deviation. So if you look at the history, it's many and varied, as most topics are, but quite simple in the original sort of premise. And that premise, to my understanding, still is valid. And so we want to talk a bit about that. I'm going to sort of reference a few other more recent papers from 2000 and 2003, that talk about portfolio construction and the measurement of portfolio performance, less on the measurement process for this conversation, but much more on the construction. And what we want to do is, I guess, look at things like the assumptions that go into when we're building these multi-manager portfolios and how people kind of impose artificial boundaries. So the idea, I want to have a hedge fund included in my multi-manager allocation, and I'm going to only allocate 5%, let's say, to that part of the universe of availability of alpha, yet I might have expected risk and return numbers that are just as high, if not higher, than my traditional asset classes. So it kind of begs the question about the logic of how we actually implement portfolios versus our expectations. So we'll cover a bit of that. This example is fictitious, although somewhat based on reality, my title is long, but I mean otherwise head of quant, so I talk about numbers a lot and make lots of numbers up, but hopefully they're real or relatively real. So I want to talk about this. So this slide here will give you a feel for what we're going to do is when it's a manager of manager problems we're going to try to solve. So this idea of as Bill talks about sort of climate change and the sort of investment opportunities there. How do we actually add something like that into a standard portfolio structure? So what I've got here, this data was, as I say, kind of fictitious, but based also on, out of the Mercer's software kit, based on global equity manager data. So we've got total return, For the benchmark, bear in mind these aren't really forecasts as such. They don't think Deutsche thinks that the world's going to do 10% return over the next whatever period. Again, it's just fictitious. So let's suppose our benchmark return expected is 10% with a total risk or a total volatility of 15%. Standard sort of assumption. And now let's suppose you've done the research on the manager universe you'd like, and you've selected these managers, core 1 to core 4, and they've got total return numbers, total risk numbers. The active return is just simply this column here minus the total return. And here's some tracking error numbers, standard sorts of numbers, 3 to 4% tracking error for my active managers in the global equity space. Maybe a bit low. Some managers have higher tracking errors, but let's just make that assumption there. And now we've got this satellite portfolio as well, which is could be a hedge fund, could be a climate change fund, whatever you like that's not core. And we're going to define not core, I guess, as something to do with correlation on the next slide. But here we have a total return expected of 18%. So it's an 8% active return versus the world, 15% total risk, and a higher tracking error than the other managers, which would tell you something about the correlation structure attached to this manager. So here's a correlation table. And so I've sort of tried to kind of partition it to make sense. These are the correlations between the core 1 manager, then core 2, core 3, core 4, the satellite manager and the benchmark. So the managers are all highly correlated to the benchmark except the satellite manager, which is sort of what we'd expect to see from a satellite manager. We want them to be relatively uncorrelated with the world in general. This manager also relatively uncorrelated between the core managers as well. So on average, quite low, I mean, 0 for this, 0.4, et cetera. So you see here that, and then the active managers, and this is true for most of the managers we see, very high correlations, and these are all total return correlations as well, not active return. So they're very highly correlated together, so when you add them together, people sort of complain about, my tracking error drops dramatically and I look kind of like the benchmark. Well, there's lots to do with the fact that in total return, at least, they tend to be very highly correlated on average. And I've got the core 2 manager here is kind of different, I guess, in a sense, where it's not as lowly correlated as satellite 1, but it is still relatively lowly correlated compared to the other managers. And for active returns, I can do an active return, the same sort of analysis, to show that my satellite manager is relatively uncorrelated or close to zero or even negatively correlated compared to my other managers, and again, which is a nice facet. So when my core managers are outperforming, maybe this guy's underperforming, or vice versa, but there's low correlation. And as Bill showed the hook charts before, how much the chart hooks basically is dependent upon the correlation structure underlying those asset returns. So the more uncorrelated you are, that kind of looks more and more like a V-shape, those charts. And so we want to see that when we're starting to add managers together. And these are the implied betas that drop out of these correlations. So you'll see here that managers 1, 3, and 4 are relatively, in terms of beta, kind of like the market. For 2 and satellite 1 are relatively, again, low risk, if you like, compared to the market. So you've got all these inputs. That's all fine. Then what we want to do is solve some problems. So the whole point of portfolio construction is, we have to have some expectations of risk and return and correlation. And also, I guess, the client expectations of their total return, total risk. When you speak to your clients, what do they tell you about what they want to achieve in their portfolio structure is something you have to take care of and account for. And in terms of, we talk about optimization in sort of quantitative language particularly. The question, of course, is what are we optimizing? Now, what I'm going to show you here is basically we're going to do 4 optimization problems. Some sort of dependent upon the other ones. And in general, what we're going to try to do here is, firstly, let's maximize the Sharpe ratio. And here I'm going to define the Sharpe ratio assuming a cash rate of 0 just to make the mathematics easy. And I'm going to say, well, the Sharpe ratio is the ratio of total risk to total return. Total return to total risk. So I want to how much per unit risk I take, how much return do I get back in total. So I'm going to investigate an allocation based on that assumption. Maximize the Sharpe ratio whilst constraining the tracking error. These are active managers that we care about, that we're going to be investing in. So they have tracking error. I want to make sure that if I'm going to add value, I'm going to get rewarded for the risk I take. So by actually constraining the tracking error rather than just letting it run free. Because after all, active managers, as I said at the start, they care about tracking error, but not about total risk necessarily. So you can look at a manager that takes lots of risk in an active sense, or even maybe not so much risk, can take a lot of risk in a total sense, so versus the benchmark risk. And that can be a big issue for, you know, your risk-return trade-off and then the sort of variability in the results that you get for your clients. So let's look at the Sharpe ratio whilst constraining tracking error, maximise information ratio, so now maximise the active return, minimise active risk or tracking error, and then do the same thing by constraining total risk as well, all in the same optimization. Now, the ideas of these sort of constraints come from these papers, particularly the one from Jorian in 2003, where he talks about the efficiency lapse by just maximising information ratio. The fact that managers don't necessarily control total risk at an individual level becomes the responsibility of the plan sponsor, in a sense of you have control of the total risk of the portfolio. That's what the client's looking for. The active managers you hire really care about the active component of risk only, and they can be, and they're uncorrelated. You know, you can sort of demonstrate how lowly total and active risk are correlated. So that's an issue. And the other paper basically talks more about the measurement process, looking at the inefficiencies of Sharpe ratios, something called the M-squared, which was by Modigliani and Modigliani, a ratio that is similar to a Sharpe ratio, and there's another ratio as well he talks about that takes account of correlation between portfolios and benchmarks and also the risk of the portfolio. I'm not going to reference that paper today, though. So here we go. We have this rather complex table. It's not so complex. Basically, this is the results of the optimization. So here I'm going to maximize my Sharpe ratio, and there's another three slides. I'm going to focus actually on slide four, but just for illustration here to explain what's happening. So here we have the core managers and the satellite. These exposures come out of the optimization. So in this case, the optimizer says to maximize the Sharpe ratio with those expected risk and returns and correlations, and these constraints of having a maximum 50% in any of these managers have a 50-50 split between core and satellite. So that's my 100%, and then my total, this is my expected total returns. You've seen all these numbers in the tables before, and this is the portfolio return, 14.5%. This is the active return, 4.5% above the benchmark, because the benchmark was 10. The portfolio risk, 11.7%. Active risk or tracking error, 2.8. The ratio, so this is this ratio, like a Sharpe ratio, an information ratio, benchmark return, et cetera, et cetera. So what we want to do is basically focus on these numbers sort of in this table. And so what we see here is that now we get a ratio, maximized Sharpe ratio. The best I could do was 1.2 times. So that's how much return per unit risk I get. And on the active side, 1.6. That's my information ratio, 1.6. So you go through the rather tedious exercise of optimizing everything, and you get to the next one, and you see some slightly different numbers. And I should actually probably have them on one table to compare them. But basically, you have a bit more tracking error, a bit more return. So I've constrained my tracking error to be 3% here, and the optimizer's achieved that goal with a lower Sharpe ratio. That's the first issue that we have. So by putting some constraint in, it doesn't always necessarily help us. That's one point. The next thing, maximise information ratio, I get a very similar Sharpe ratio of 1, but now I get a much higher information ratio. So my per unit active risk I take, I get lots more return back. I also get a bit more volatility, it turns out. That's all actually around the same sort of level of volatility. That can be okay. There are examples I can show you where the vol's much higher. So the fourth example that we have is this sort of, let me target, the client wants to have global equity exposure. That's the whole purpose of their coming to us to talk to us about their equity portfolio. So let's target the same risk as the benchmark that we expect to see, but let's maximize our information ratio above and beyond the benchmark return. So in this case, I've got a benchmark risk of 15%, which is what we said originally, which matches this number here. I get a portfolio return of 14.9, so about a 1% there. But also, I do get this, you know, a decent information ratio of 2.2 out of it. Solutions 3 and 4 are very similar if you go look at the numbers. And it's probably my lack of creativeness in making the numbers up. I could have shown other examples that were probably much more stark. But the point here is that, and this is in line with the Jorian paper, and he showed this as well, that it's this sort of process that actually produces very good quality portfolios in the sense of rewarding not just active risk for active return, but also making sure that the client doesn't get over kind of sort of penalised for taking too much total risk on board because the active managers don't actually account for it. Now, the other important thing to all of this is that if you look at these allocations, they're very large and probably larger than most people put in their portfolio. So, for example, the Satellite 1, which is our alternative sort of asset class, at a third to a half of the portfolio, seems kind of odd to many people. And it's interesting that it's, to me that it's odd, because if you kind of let this thing, this is not quite an unconstrained optimization, because I do have a benchmark risk issue, and also I've got this 50% upper boundary on the asset classes. But we don't really hit the upper boundary, so it doesn't come into play. So it's really not it's not a binding constraint. Interestingly, that now, what does it imply if you know you say to the client, well, I only really want to have, I don't know, 5% or 10% in the alternative asset class. The implication in terms of optimization and portfolio construction is that you don't actually believe these numbers here. You don't believe 18% total return and 15% total risk. Because if you did, this is the solution that you'd generate, this solution here. You'd have much more in these alternative asset classes. And so either one of two things is kind of wrong. Either you don't believe your own forecasts, which is kind of odd because you made them, or I made them. And the other thing then is that, so if that's the case, then you really have to if either you don't believe that or you don't believe this, well, this is just a logical process with no kind of gut feel attached to it, in the sense of it's an automated process. It just flows. It's a sort of a straight through process of going from returns into portfolio weights. So we have these big issues around, you know, when we want to add these things in. So from our point of view, you know, people should be adding a lot more of these sorts of asset classes to their strategies, which I think has been sort of, you know, shown to be true, particularly in some of the US pension funds and things, where they do have much larger allocations to a lot of these more alternative assets, and they've been very successful because of it. And so it's a contradiction, it seems to me, to if I say this is 5%, this number probably drops to something like maybe 5 or 6%. In terms of that's my expected return. That makes no sense, because it's just there is this internal inconsistency. So when we build these portfolios and you sort of look at this sort of process of, you know, controlling for benchmark risk and controlling for tracking error or whatever it is, and having these forecasts in place, that to then override the process is counterintuitive. And nobody's ever really explained to me why, except it's normally something along the lines of, well, there's another sort of risk which is kind of competitor risk. So the fact is that, you know, I don't want to look too different from the competition. Why, I say? If you really believe these numbers, and you're right, you know, you should have 32% in the thing, not 5%. So it's sort of this idea of how we actually build expectations, you know, is quite an interesting sort of game, and one that's not well played on average, in my opinion. And so, you know, these sort of things, you know, we should actually consider quite carefully, and understand sort of the belief structures, I guess, and the expectations that not just we, the clients have, but we have about these sorts of ideas. So that's, I think, almost where I finish. And Bill might come up and talk a bit more about megatrends. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. I might add that I've had the pleasure of working with Paul for 11 years. That's the first time I've ever seen him do a presentation without putting up a mathematical formula, so well done. The key reason we've talked about this is that obviously we believe and we're absolutely convinced that the Australian market now, which is a very sophisticated one globally, investors very much accept the idea that a key global equity portfolio is what you need. And they're now reaching the point where you can put around these extra sources of alpha around that portfolio. And they're the sorts of products that other managers, as well as us, are going to be bringing to you. And these are going to be sector funds. They might be a BRIC fund, the next 11 emerging markets. It could be a water fund. It could be global agribusiness. It could be climate change. But these are above and beyond that basic risk that those investors are taking in terms of the MSCI World Index. So we're looking for alpha above and beyond that. So that's the whole reason that we've gone into looking at how these things can be included in portfolios. And I think it makes a lot of sense. This looks at the world as most investors see it. It's the MSCI World Index, the country shown there in red. We don't see the world this way. We see the world as one market, one economy, and this would include the emerging markets. If you just look at the MSCI World Index, you can see clearly here it's 26, 27 developed countries if we include New Zealand. apologies to Graham Rich, if he's in the room. But basically, it excludes 5 billion people on this planet. 3 billion of those are these new consumers that we're looking at. It excludes China, India, South Korea, Taiwan, obviously emerging Asia, Latin America, emerging Eastern Europe, and we think it's just naive to exclude these companies, the potential from these companies. So when we look at the world, we want to look at it. What we do is we're looking for ideas rather than the MSCI index, because it's a backward-looking thing. It's not looking forward. And what we want to do is find companies that are driven by change. Companies face that one constant, and that's change. So what we are looking for are those tailwinds or those ideas that are driving change and those secular trends. And we call those ideas themes in our global portfolio. And the key premise with all of that is a case of not if these things are going to happen, but when they are inevitable. And we've talked about some of those inevitabilities. The other thing that's happening out there in the emerging world is we have this attack of industrial advantage that's benefiting companies from the emerging world. And we have three columns, one headed emerging markets, contested industries, and developed markets. We believe the industries under the emerging market heading have already fallen to companies from the emerging world. If you look at DRAM, microchips, the South Koreans, the Taiwanese make these more cheaply than anyone else on the planet by a factor of about three times. If you look at PCs, they ceased to be in the developed world when IBM sold out to Lenovo a couple of years back, the Chinese company. On the contested side, consumer electronics, I think, has probably already fallen. We think Samsung has beaten Sony on that. They're outspending Sony in terms of research and development. They're roughly spending $3 million US dollars every hour on R&D. They've got a product roadmap that extends out over 10 years. They're the world leaders in flat-screen technology. The auto side, we think China and India alone in 5 years could be producing as many as 45 million cars per annum. The developed world currently makes about 26 to 27 million cars per annum now. On the developed market side, that's really the industries you're going to be left with if you're just an MSCI red country investor. And basically, that doesn't provide a huge opportunity set. So going forward, you're going to have emerging markets in a portfolio. The key question is, how do you do it? You can have an MSCI manager. You can bolt on an emerging market specialist. That would be one way. But this is not just a one-way street. There's obviously companies from the developed world that are building plant and factories in the emerging world, and they're going to be winners as well. So we think it makes more sense to look at the world as one economy, one market, and find the best companies irrespective of where they happen to be listed, and the ones that are most appropriately priced as well, obviously. Looking at global agribusiness, this comes from the business of feeding the world. What do we define it as? It's basically the food chain of the food business, everything right through from the farm all the way through to the consumer's plate. Obviously, it's centered on the farm. You've got the inputs from these things here on the left, seeds and fertilizers, companies that specialize in agrochemicals, seed speciality, fertilizers such as Potash Company of Saskatchewan, land and plantations, companies like Australian Agriculture. Aquaculture is a key part of all this. The UN predicts fish consumption is going to rise 20 to 40% over the next 12 years. We simply can't take that from the sea. It's going to be impossible. We'll have no wild stock left. So aquaculture becomes critical in all of this. Companies involved in water, desalination, ultrafiltration, membrane technology, irrigation, recycling, huge potential, but at the moment they're very highly priced. Not a lot of upside for them because there are actually discrete water funds out there. We've seen billions of dollars flow into those globally in the last couple of years. On the machinery side, it's the harvesters, the plows, the tractors, the farmers themselves, the people that lend money to the farmers, storage, processing, distribution and marketing of all that product, as well as biofuel, a key part of all that. One thing I didn't mention at the start when I was talking about scarcity of land, if you plant more land to biofuel, there's less land available for food. What do you expect to happen to the price of food? It's rising, and it's rising all over the world for this reason. We think this is a secular trend. It's not cyclical. It's long-term, and people have been paying less as part of their disposable income for food for probably two centuries. We think we've reached an inflection point, and we will all be paying more for food as a percentage of our disposable income as we go forward. In terms of We've actually broken it up into resource owners, facilitators, value adders, collectors and distributors. The resource owners and facilitators are basically covered. Value adders are people involved in distribution, wholesaling, these sorts of areas. A company like Olam Holdings, which is a Singapore-based company that specializes in aggregating food supply right from the farmer's gate. They buy up crops, spices, they aggregate those into large things and they sell directly to the global food companies, Nestle's Kraft Foods. And on the collector, the other fourth part here on the right, basically we're looking there at an example would be, we wouldn't normally put supermarkets into a portfolio in this idea, but in the emerging world we're finding where we've got some economies moving from street stalls all the way into the early stages of supermarket development, we're getting extremely high growth rates, sometimes in the order of 30 to 40% per annum. And that's happening in Turkey with a company called Migros Turk and a Russian one called X5. So there are some examples for global agribusiness. Just in conclusion, I think we do see these specialist investment strategies or mega trends providing investors with access to major global forces. These things are shifting the economy and the investment landscape. Traditional portfolio construction that treats such investments as satellites may not in fact be providing investors the most optimal solution. This idea that you can just put 5% into these things because typically the asset consultants don't understand yet how to deal with them. And there's a low correlation, high potential return, with well-defined volatility investment process should be rewarded in a fund of funds portfolio. I think the work that Paul's done has shown that quite clearly, and we believe that maximizing the information ratio whilst constraining that total risk provides an efficient solution while ensuring that the client's rewarded for active and particularly market risk. So that's pretty much all we've got to say. We'd be delighted to take some questions.